Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the October 12th San Francisco County Board of Supervisors meeting. If you'd all join me in the Pledge of Allegiance, please.
Say with me, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. And all's well in the world of baseball, the Giants are going to be moving on.
If there has to be a team for California to do that.
Yeah. Sure. If it's not the Angels, you know.
It wasn't what I was thinking.
Madam Clerk, if there are changes to the agenda, please.
There are changes to the closed session. And that's what I left behind.
Okay.
We've added a couple of items to closed session. Do you have
them? I can read them here if you like. They are any litigation.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
There you go.
I got it. Okay. Thank you. There's added items to closed session under pending litigation. Number 15, Shears et al. Versus County of SLO, Court of Appeal. Number 16, Sunny Acres et al. Versus County of San Luis Obispo. All requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, ma'am. We have no items on the consent, so we'll move right into public comment. First will be Julie Rodewald up first and Mr. Patterson up second.
Good morning, Julie Rodewald, County Clerk Recorder. Just a reminder to voters that next Monday, October 18th, is the final day to register to vote for the upcoming November 2nd general election, and that's all I have to say today. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to let everyone know that the Strategic Energy Alliance for Change is sponsoring a forum on Proposition 23, which would effectively suspend the Global Warming Solution Act, AB 32, if it's passed. That forum is this Thursday, October 14th, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. in the City County Library in San Luis Obispo. We'll be having a forum with speakers representing opposition to Proposition 23 and speakers speaking in favor of Proposition 23. Andy Caldwell from CoLab and Ed Waggy, who is on the City Council in Pismo Beach, will be speaking in favor of Prop 23, and Kent Smokoska, who is the coordinator of green technology at Cuesta College, and our own Supervisor Gibson will be speaking in opposition to 23. So the forum will be moderated by the League of Women Voters. And again, it's this Thursday, 5:30 at, well, actually it starts at 6 at the City-County Library here in San Luis Obispo. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Taylor, followed by Ben DeFada, please.
Good morning. My name is Glenn Taylor. I'm a resident of Los Osos. The county has considered Los Osos a stepchild and has never addressed the needs of that stepchild. The county was noticed by the Regional Water Quality Control of saltwater intrusion into the only water basin Los Osos has back in 1970. Engineers, including the county's own engineers, reported saltwater intrusion, yet nothing took place, no addressing the problem. When the Water Board initiated 8313, the Septic Tank Management District that included all of Los Osos was part of 8313. Under the Memorandum of Understanding, the county was to develop this Septic Tank Management Program. The community did their part and did a survey of the community in 1993 as the first step in determining the location of each septic tank on each said property. The county never set the Septic Tank Maintenance District up, but insists and allowed more development, more than 1,100 homes in what is the prohibition zone now. If the county had addressed the saltwater intrusion and the water board's perceived septic tank problems in a timely manner, this board would not have to make the decisions regarding Los Osos that are confronting you all today. There are people stopping their newspapers, stopping their phones, stopping their cables, wondering if this time their medication costs are going to go up, if they are going to afford to be able to pay for them. Are their families going to be able to have their medical insurance? Are they going to have a roof over their head next week? Food to feed the families? A job? Or are they going to have more houses out of equity to less money than they had because they are being furloughed? Then the question, can I pay for the sewer cost, and when is the county going to tell me how much per month in total I am supposed to try and pay, or am I going to lose everything? This board is going to be the deciders. Your consciences are going to be the deciders. Remember the people who may be out there on the street after
Thank
their
you.
Decisions.
Mr. DeFada, followed by Leon Golden, please.
Morning, Chairman Meacham and board. It's good to see your smiling faces again. Ben DeFada here. Another $750,000 to Gibson and Pavo for their unaffordable, overpriced, faulty gravity project, resulting in more financial ruination of this county's taxpayers and people of Los Osos again. Chairman Meacham, we are disturbed why the other three supervisors on your board just don't get it. Keep voting to continue giving Gibson and Orford more money for this unaffordable, stinking, overpriced gravity project. Is this the best you can do for Los Osos? Don't you other three supervisors understand that Gibson is a big spender with other people's money, and Auburn, who can sell used camels to Eskimos? You three have been sold a herd of used camels by these two spinners and his staff. How can you get best value when you have not been exposed to affordable vacuum and low-pressure technology on purpose? I'm sure that when your home needs painting or roof repairs, you get at least two, three bids. If you have auto insurance, auto accidents, I'm sure your insurance company requires two, three bids. Yet on this project, by giving these two more money, pursuing only gravity, all you have done is prolong the agony of our people. Vacuum and low-pressure technologies have to be in the mix of competing against gravity, too. Gibson and Auburn have kept this from you on purpose. Gibson and Pavo has to be fired from this project. Auburn is an at-will employee and should be fired as public works director. Based on his education and credentials, he was never qualified to be a public works director. He has never built a sewer project. He clearly has conflicts of interest. He has divided loyalties, and he has manipulated the shortlist firms to gravity only. He has done a disservice to you and us by not looking at other affordable alternatives. He has delivered nothing of value and loss of millions of dollars to us. Went way over budget on this project from $2 million to $8 million in the last 3 years. We could have went over to Kinko's and made copies of the past work we already paid for to the tune of over $20 million done by the same engineering firm. What did you expect? We could have packaged it and delivered it to you 3 years ago. No, my friends, you and Los Osos have been deceived by Auburn, who needs to be fired post-haste. Just a mere suspicion of wrongdoing demands an investigation. He has cost the county and us a lot of money. So far, it appears your board doesn't believe in competitive bidding. If this project was in one of your districts, you would think a district. I bet you would. Chairman Meacham and board, you don't like it when Sacramento raises our county's emergency fund. Well, us taxpayers don't like it either. We want a sewer project, but one that's affordable. Proven alternatives are available now and are being used all over the world.
Thank you, Mr. DeFada.
Thank you, sir.
Golden, please, followed by Eric Greening.
We'll start digging up the streets yet.
First of all, let me begin by saying that I hope you listen carefully to what Gwen Taylor had to say. It's something that really needs to be considered, and I join in her remarks. Secondly, I'd like to thank Supervisor Meacham for his vote last week. Unfortunately, I couldn't be here, but that was excellent. He voted no on the $750,000 that's being poured into this project, the project being the sewer. And secondly, I'd also like to thank Supervisor Catchell for his vote, which was a yes vote. Now, the reason I'm thanking him is because I know he's a candidate for office. He's running to be to replace our assemblyman in Sacramento. And he's showing now to the entire community how he's going to deal with the public's money. And it's sort of surprising because that it was a yes vote. Since he's running on the ticket of the party of no, and what he should have voted is no. I should add to my remarks the fact that I do not live in the prohibition zone, and he's spending money, not only money that's been collected as taxes from me, but from all sorts of other people throughout this county. And I would ask you in all sincerity, what do you think would happen if we put the question of spending all this over $8 million to the voters of this county? You think they would have voted yes? I think you know they would have voted no.
Greening, please, followed by Martha Golden.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I have several topics to hit. First, I appreciate the clarification both here and at the Water Resources Advisory Committee relative to how the Paso Robles Resource Capacity Study is being approached. My understanding is that the joint meeting on November 9th is a study session where everyone gets the information and has the chance to ask the experts about it. Then the Planning Commission will independently come to their own determination, and then you will come to your own determination, and that it is possible to take effective action regardless of how this synchronizes or doesn't with the rest of the RMS process. I know you're going to be discussing a labor issue later today, and a non-county one with which you're involved that should also be on your radar screens is relative to the Regional Transit Authority. A final offer is going to be before the represented employees for a vote, and depending how that vote goes, we could suddenly be in a rather sticky situation with a strike looming. And so I'm hoping that as members of the RTA board, you are ready to take whatever action is needed to essentially take control of the process. By the way, happy rideshare month, and I hope everyone did try transit during Tri-Transit Week, and we have to keep that option viable and keep the people providing that option well paid, meaning better paid than they are now. I hope some of you took advantage of the Open Studios weekend. The first Open Studios weekend was in the North County last weekend. It'll be from San Luis Obispo South this weekend, and then Encore all over the county the following weekend. Good time to do holiday shopping. Finally, I want to throw something into our legislative platform that is an issue of process rather than content, but I think is critical. I think it's absolutely inexcusable that after the Big Five came up with a product, it was not revealed to us for almost a week until the legislators were safely in the Capitol building in Sacramento, so that we, the people, and even they could not read it and familiarize ourselves with it, so that we could not communicate with our representatives as to our desires to pass it or not pass it or how it would need to be changed, essentially to keep everyone in the dark until the last minute. The legislature gave us a great gift when they gave us the Brown Act. We know they don't have to live by it, but they should at least be told in no uncertain terms that they should live by the spirit of it, and that an educated public is the best governors of our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Martha Golden, please, followed by Richard Margeson.
Good morning, Martha Golden, Los Osos. Seems that one of the topics of discussion this morning is cost of the sewer. It is my understanding that last week, after the county said that it had loans to pay for at least some of the sewer project, the figure that the county lit upon for the paying back of the assessment, the amount of money that the homeowners in the prohibition zone agreed they would pay back, the approximately $25,000 a residence, was set at $105 a month, tentatively. That $105 a month is, by my poor arithmetic, $1,260 a year added to the tax bill that every homeowner will get. However, the problem with that is, and people in the prohibition zone, please be alert, it will not pay for the sewer. There had been talk originally, oh, the undeveloped properties will have a 218 vote, and they'll vote for it, and that'll make up whatever shortfall there is for the capital cost of building the project. Well, that's not going to happen. Instead, the county has embarked upon the course of having rates and charges. Now, good burgers of the prohibition zone, you won't get a ballot for the rates and charges. You will not be asked whether you want to pay anywhere from $30, $40, $50, $90, $100 a month on top of the $105. You will have to take the initiative if you think you can't afford the additional cost. If you're just opposed to taxes in general, if you feel that it is a poor project and you don't want to pay the additional costs, you will have to take the affirmative step. Now, the final amount hasn't been determined. I believe that the end of this month, at a Board of Supervisors meeting, there will be an ordinance proposed. What exactly the process will be, how much money, I don't know. Members of the Board of Supervisors know all of that or will know at that date. But I want to alert the people of Los Osos, whose tax bill may go up another $100 a month or maybe more, that they will have to be on the alert and will have to take affirmative steps if they want to say no to any additional costs for an unaffordable, antiquated sewer project. Thank you.
Mr. Margeson, followed by Mr. Barrow, please.
Richard Margeson, good morning. Last week, we got the Los Osos update. Staff report was 38 pages. There was no indication in the introduction that there was going to be an emphasis placed on the rates and charges ordinance. In the staff report, 1.25 pages. 1.25 pages. Addresses this issue. It should have been a separate agenda item. Maybe not last week, but any of the open afternoons that you had in the last 2 months, you should have thoroughly vetted this. Staff recommendation was 90-10, 90 fixed, 10 variable. Mr. Gibson indicated off the bat that he was kind of leaning in that direction. But the minute his board partner, Mr. Patterson, went 55-45, that pretty much ended the discussion. It's now been sent back to staff at 55-45 with not an ounce of in-depth discussion about what the implications of that are going to be on the community. You're going to bring it back October 26th on consent calendar. On consent calendar. And unless one of you pull it, you're going to set it for the 45-day period and have your final hearing in December. Staff is going, I can tell you now, staff is going to screw this one up if you don't have some serious discussion of this. You have pretty much taken the affordability that you're all so concerned about out of this project based on a 55-45 scale. It seemed last week that Mr. Gibson wanted to have that discussion between the two scenarios. Never happened. Never happened. You need to look at that chart and see what it's, what you are doing to the possibility of families staying in the community or the future possibilities of families moving to that community. Because when this gets online, costs are going to be out there to verify. And people are going to know what it costs to live in Los Osos, and families aren't going to move there. That should have been a separate hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Barlow. My last request is Elaine Watson, please.
Good morning. My name is Al Barrow, Coalition for Low Income Housing. How are you this morning? I hope you're well. I hope you, the fog is off of your brain. I know it's still out there, but you need to sharpen up your pencils on the sewer project because it's not really cutting the mustard. What you have on the table and what was rejected by the chair last week is an unaffordable project with high mitigations because of this high impacts for this project. Yesterday I learned that in order to rent rentals, property managers had to drop their costs from 10% to 15% across the board. Now that property management company run 600 properties, but I'm sure to be competitive, others have done the same. It indicates to you that in a jobless recovery, many households don't have the same amount of income that they had in the past, and they can't make the rent. They can't make the mortgage payment. This is a jobless recovery. If you look at the news, you'll see that people all over the country are underwater. There's 12 million foreclosures going on right now. This project should be sensitive to the conditions under which we are living now, which have changed radically. And we're likely to have a 10-year trough where we go sideways on the economy. Stock market is doing fine because they've cut employment, they've cut their expenses, and they can do that and show a profit. But there's a lot of stuff that's coming down the pipe that's going to really push the affordability of housing into a real tough, tough thing for families. We have 1,300 children, 1,300 school-aged children that are living in the streets of our county. Come on, guys. We need to get a program to help these people. We certainly don't need to have Los Osos, which is now considered one of the most affordable areas for rentals, to become one of the least affordable. And that's what this sewer project does. It really doesn't consider, Bruce, the fact that we're going to lose our housing. How would you like it if somebody told you that your Orange Grove and your family business is bankrupt and you're going to have to get off of that property? That's what we're facing with here, folks. We're facing losing our housing, whether it's rental housing, which is 30% of Los Osos, or the other thing. Would you just flip this up on the screen? I'm proposing that we have a safe parking lot program, and here's the model for it, and I'm hoping that somebody will support that. And thank you for your vote, Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Barrow. Ms. Watson, please, and my last one this time is Mr. Bard.
Good morning. Elaine Watson, Los Osos. In the Tribune last week, there was an article following the Los Osos update. And David Sneed, the author of that article, seems to focus on Mr. Meacham's no vote for these additional $750,000, which brings our exploratory phase cost of this up to almost $8 million, or about $8 million. He says, Mr. Mitchum has been a critic of the continued use of county general funds to keep the project alive. Mr. Mitchum says the cost of this project just keep escalating. And he goes on to say that Mr. Mitchum himself is the spending is keeping him awake at night. Following this article, it was posted on the internet. Following this article, there were several postings. I'm going to read you one of the postings from one of the people who read this. His name is not attached. This is an anonymous person in Los Osos. He says, my monthly Social Security income is $484.80 per month, and my civil service retirement is $163 per month. No one talked to me about affordability. I will have to forget about food and heat in the winter. I am impoverished now. There is no other place that I can cut expenses. I am in my late 70s and have no family. I have no place to go. There are probably lots of people in the same boat as I am in. Supervisor Mitchum said, according to this article, that the spending has been keeping him awake at night. How would he like to trade places? There are many people in Los Osos in this situation. We have many elderly. You've heard this many, many times here before, but it is a reality. And that's what should be keeping all of you awake at night. What Gwen Taylor said, what other speakers have said, is absolutely true. This is critical. You have made decisions along the way that have made this increasingly unaffordable, even for the people that have a little bit more money than this gentleman does. Last week, you canceled the design-build process, which is known to be the most cost-effective, most time-effective process for getting these construction projects done, yet you eliminated it. Mr. Ogren's presentation about that design build was a falsehood. He told you that Perk Water had gone far over estimate in their building in their Santa Paula project. In fact, it was less than 1% over. And half of that less than 1% was at the count at the city's request. There are far more facts that need to be examined closely. And I hope that you will take this seriously and do some more work on this.
Thank you.
Come back to it. Thank you.
Bart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Upland Research Science Action attempts to complement coastal action groups such as Surf Rider. And I would like to bring to your attention on an advisory basis that the Water Resources Advisory Committee is agendizing for their November 3rd meeting, the addition of a developer seat, which is fine, I think it's needed, but I would suggest that your environmental contacts be alert that it might also be appropriate to balance the addition of a developer seat, a home builder seat, with an additional environmental seat, specifically a coastkeeper local unit or a watershed and creeks-oriented group. That's November 3rd. Also, as a heads up to this honorable board, may wish to visit the Bioneers Convention at Cal Poly this weekend. I'm sure you've seen the advertising. I've been lucky enough to land a volunteer slot to help out. And there are many free events. We'll broadcast from Marin County the eminent Dr. Jane Goodall, who has 50 years' experience in the field with wildlife preservation, and some of the early scientific pioneers who first alerted us to the fact of global warming. Finally, regarding an issue that we'll be facing this board late this year and early next year, the California Valley Solar Ranch, and SunPower is certainly doing a yeoman's job of addressing the very important endangered species issues. I also took a ride out there and would alert this board and your staff and the members of the public to seriously consider whether we actually have a unique world-class visual resource north of Highway 58, east of Soda Lake Road, when the sun is going down. In my capacity as Upland Research Science Action Executive Director, I'd like to put out a call to artists in particular, and photographers in particular, go take a look at this site north of Highway 58. It has been suggested that the solar collectors be aggregated south of Highway 58, and I'm inclined to endorse that. I just feel that Highway 58 east of Soda Lake Road is an incredible aesthetic resource to be found nowhere else. I could be wrong, but I do invite people to take a serious look. That's a marvelous piece of road, and in addition to the very important endangered species management issues, I think that the aesthetics issue warrants consideration. So thank you for your time, and I will yield the floor.
Thank you. That concludes our public comment portion. I just want to say a couple of things here, because I think that, as I mentioned to the folks from Los Osos when I became chairman of the board, I told you that I would give you your 3 minutes and I would give you due respect for your time, and I've done that. All I asked for in return was that same respect when the board was deliberating. And yet I heard folks out there talking, they would make comments that would go back and forth and disrupt our ability to deliberate those actions. You have a right to be able to say what you want to say, and I know that there's frustration out there. But I've given you the respect of the time. So I would ask, though, that when we get into discussion, if you want to talk about that, you can hear us in the hallway, and you can sit out there and you can make your comments, whatever you like. Or you can set up a meeting with me and yell at me. But I've given you the respect, and I'm asking you that you give us the time that we need to be able to deliberate our discussions. Thank you. We're going to move into board items at this point. Madam Clerk, first item.
Item A1 is submittal of a resolution of intent to participate in the Great Shakeout and work toward becoming a safer community.
Mr. Alsop.
Good morning. Ron Alsop, County Office of Emergency Services. We're here today to ask for your support through this resolution to encourage county and public in participation in what's referred to as the Great California Shakeout. And quite simply, all it is a statewide drop, cover, and hold on earthquake exercise. As we all know, in fact, as recently as this weekend in the Los Angeles Times and somewhat touched on in a Tribune article this weekend, is that geologists are now expecting or anticipating, projecting, whatever the appropriate term is in geoscience world, that the big one could be as large as 8.1. As a history reminder, in 1857, one of the largest earthquakes in California originated in the Parkfield area, just north of our county line, and ripped through our eastern portion of our county and down to Fort Tejon. It was believed to be about a 7.8 or 7.9. What's projected now is a repeat of that, however, starting in Parkfield and ripping through our county and all the way down to the Salton Sea, over 300-mile distance of an 8.1 earthquake. It could happen right now. We could all be long gone. There's just no knowing what's going to happen with that. As we're also well aware, we have other faults that are closer to us, and obviously we're very unfortunately experienced with an actual earthquake with two fatalities in 2003. So it is earthquake country. This is something to take seriously. And what we're asking for with the resolution is simply your support for our participation in the County of San Luis Obispo's participation in the Great California Shakeout of 2010. Last year, 6.9 million people participated. As of this morning, there are 6.7 million people already signed up. And in conjunction, as noted in your staff report, in conjunction with County Human Resources Risk Management Safety Officer, we're actually going to have a county-wide, for county employees, a drop, cover, and hold-on exercise on the date of the Great California Shakeout, which is going to be on October 21st at 10:21 a.m. To get 10:21 at 10:21. So we ask for your support through this resolution, and with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. We did have a great shakeout on that date. My son was born.
All right.
Comments from the board. Mr.
Actually,
Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do appreciate Mr. Alsop's work in all manners of emergency services and preparedness. And certainly I'm supportive of our participation here. I think it's a fundamental importance that we raise awareness, earthquake preparedness, and how to remain safe. But as I was reading
the articles that projected a potentially larger than previously expected earthquake. I'm wondering if, beyond the immediate need for us to be safe should an earthquake affect this area, whether your office works in a wider connection up and down the state. Because what occurred to me was that a devastating earthquake either in the metropolitan area south of us or north of us could so seriously disrupt those huge population centers that even if we didn't sustain much damage, that there would be statewide effects and there would be the need to mount a statewide response to something large like that. So beyond the immediate protections here, I'm wondering if you have any experience or whether there's any systems in place that might be able to help mitigate that on a wider scale.
Yes, we do. We participate in a number of cooperative agreements and working relationships with other areas. As you touch on, obviously, with the over 300-mile, potentially 8.1 earthquake is going to affect the Southland, and a disaster that we have here locally, that's where we count a lot of our resources. If those are not going to be available, we're set up in California. The 58 counties are called, what in emergency management terms, what are operational areas. If resources aren't available from Southern California, we'll get them from Northern California. We have a number of mutual aid agreements that we actually are signatories to over the years, since 1950, in fact. And as far as working cooperatively outside the region, in fact, later this month, in a couple of weeks, I'll be at a meeting down in Santa Fe Springs, meeting with all the Southern California counties, as well as the state to coordinate efforts such as not only earthquake preparedness, but as you touched on, other disaster preparedness efforts as well. And we also, for this particular aspect, have just formally joined the Earthquake Country Alliance, which is a group that consists of the California Emergency Management Agency, American Red Cross, and a number of other agencies.
Thanks, sir. Thank you, Mr. Alsop. And I think that, you know, far too often we become a little complacent when we say we have an earthquake. We think, well, that's it. We're not going to have another one for a while. But just like a lot of other natural disasters, I mean, we're prone to so many. So I do appreciate your efforts, and I think that the board is willing to participate in this great shakeout. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have a couple requests from the audience to speak on this. Mr. Bard, followed by Eric Green.
Thank you. I have had the privilege of training multiple disaster preparedness trainings with the American Red Cross, and I took the emergency medical technician training, completed it. I'm not actually current, and I participated in disaster preparedness at the firehouse, and I'm particularly impressed by the emerging community resilience model. And the reason I'm addressing the board basically is to call your attention to the fact that we have a unique world-class geological display of the effects of an earthquake at Wallace Creek at the Carrizo Plain National Monument area, and perhaps in connection with the Great Shakeout, folks might take a look at it. It's a situation where a natural creek bed has slid differentially with the earthquake so that the stream runs in an S shape out at Wallace Creek. So there's also perhaps a tourist angle. We always like to have tourist revenue and ecotourism, and certainly the Wallace Creek site is an amazing, amazing site, and it's right here in this county. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Greening?
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and first I agree with the previous speaker. As a matter of fact, many of the features of our landscape owe themselves to earthquakes. There are even places in some of the coastal mountains where uplifted former seabed still shows the sign of submarine landslides that are now eroded creek, where creeks are backing up into the hills and eroding, and you can actually see the structure of previous landslides caused by earthquakes as they affected submarine canyons and so on. So much of our landscape was generated by these, but of course, having placed so many vulnerable structure on a landscape that sometimes shakes, we do need to practice to be safe during the events that are inevitable. A couple of other issues that come up in that connection, certainly one is the very important issue of statewide impacts from a major earthquake anywhere in the state, how it would affect our local transportation, not to mention our transportation funding, and the funding of other services, how we would participate in community with the rest of the state in recovery. But a couple of specific issues that are of concern, both in terms of local decision making and in terms of working with Sacramento and whoever happens to be representing us there. One is the devastation of our state water system that is very likely from a major quake anywhere between the Bay Area and Los Angeles. As a matter of fact, the Los Angeles Basin imports water across the San Andreas Fault in three different places, State Water Project, the Eastern Sierra Water, and the Colorado River Water all cross the San Andreas Fault. Our coastal branch of the State Water Project also crosses the fault, and I know they have a flexible section at the place where they think it's the most vulnerable. We'll see how that holds up whenever the time comes. But we need to be prepared for devastation of water systems. And of course, another issue is locally making sure that we're completely up to date with dam safety and evacuation plans. And then a final issue that is a matter of state law, all quisbriolo zones where you take special care in construction are based on proximity to a fault. They need to also be based on soil type. Saturated alluvium, it doesn't matter how close you are to a fault, you're vulnerable. If you have a bowl full of jello and you're shaking the bowl like this, the jello is like this. And actually, we shouldn't even be building on the jello.
Thank you.
But much of what we have is.
Thank you, Mr. Green. I would urge folks, the preparedness issue is one of a major concern, because in times of a disaster, don't depend upon someone to come and rescue you right away. You need to be prepared yourself. And I would urge you to go on either the Red Cross website or just contact our Emergency Operations Center folks. There's kits that you can be provided with. They're not that much. They don't cost that much. I've got one in my pickup, one in my wife's car, and I've got two of them at home in case something ever happens that you can get through it. So just get yourselves prepared.
With that, Mr. Chairman, I would move approval of this resolution of intent to participate.
Second. I have a motion by Supervisor Gibson, seconded by Supervisor Asajian. Roll call, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Asajian?
Aye.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes. Next item, ma'am.
Item A2 is consideration of a report regarding the county's fiscal outlook for fiscal year 2011-2012.
Mr. Grant.
Thank you very much, Chairman Meacham and members of the board. Jim Grant, County Administrator. This morning we have two related items to present and discuss with you this morning. The first is a financial forecast for the next fiscal year that begins July 1, 2011. And then we have a companion piece regarding labor relations strategies. Those strategies take into consideration pension cost sharing for the existing employees, a second-tier pension plan for new employees, and also we're looking at negotiation strategies under the prevailing wage ordinance that we find ourselves legislated by. So to put today in perspective, as everyone knows, these aren't the best of times, and like everyone else, we've had to take a long, hard look at how we deal with our finances and how to decide to prioritize our limited funding and still provide those core services such as public protection and health and social services. So with your board's commitment to fiscal stability, you have dealt with budget gaps over the last 3 years of $18 million, $30 million, and $17 million. Now, you've managed these gaps by taking some proactive steps to balancing the budget by adopting short and long-range strategies that we're going to talk about today, and Mr. Buckshire will introduce in just a few moments. You also have a core group of department heads that are committed to financial management, and they worked hard to keep the budget under control. And as a matter of fact, last year returned about $2 million to the budget so that we could utilize that in this current year's budget. So that was all awfully helpful. Additionally, you've had some employee groups themselves have stepped up and assisted by deferring wages increases for a year. That did help prevent layoffs to their fellow employees. So there's quite an effort to stay balanced and within the budget as we deal with these fiscal dilemmas that we've been dealing with for the last 3 years. And as you'll see in a few moments, next year is no different. We're going to have a budget gap again. Not quite as great as it has been, and that's good. We're moving in the right direction. But we're looking at a budget gap of around $9 million, maybe $9 to $15 million, depending on how things go. So we still have a lot of work to do in preparing for next year. And to do that, we're going to start with Assistant County Administrator Dan Buckshy and his fiscal year forecast that he'll describe to you right now and talk about what's going to, we think is going to happen and how we're going to and how we're going to deal with that. And right after that, we have, a companion piece that does discuss labor relations strategy and how it fits in with this overall picture. So with that, we'll start today with the financial update, moving into the labor relations and compensation update. And next,
I'll be here. Buckshy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good morning. I'm going to hit on a couple different areas. We'll start off with a review of general economic conditions and trends. Then we'll jump into the detailed forecast for our county's general fund. Then we'll talk through the budgeting balancing strategies that we've been using for the past 3 years and are recommending to continue to use for the next few years. And then lastly, we will talk through the as many details we have about the state budget that was just approved by the legislature late Thursday, early Friday, and that the governor reviewed Friday and Saturday. We don't have a lot of detail at this point, but we do have some information to share. So with that being said, what's the bottom line for this upcoming year? Is that it's a similar story. Well, that's not working quite right. New year, we got a problem. And but the good news is that the budget balancing strategies are working. Not sure why these things are flying over the place here. Didn't do that earlier.
Is this the state thing we're doing?
So the bottom line, the positive news is that the balancing strategies are working. To illustrate the point here that I mentioned that things have not changed much this past year, the next three slides are the same slides verbatim that I used in last year's presentation. And that is that the cause of concern, you can see here we have a record national debt. It is now up to $13.5 trillion, which equates to $43,700 per citizen or $122,000 per taxpayer. It's obviously the largest national debt that this country's had. Along the same lines, the federal budget deficit is at record levels of about $1.3 trillion. To put a trillion into perspective, it is always hard to do. A trillion seconds would equal 31,688 years, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about in terms of dollars. Continuing, obviously, the housing market is still weak, and one of the big drivers of that is that credit is tight. Even those who have good credit are having difficulty getting it, both for those looking to buy a home as well as for those who are in the building industry trying to get commercial loans to build developments. Foreclosures continue to be a problem. And unemployment remains high. We'll look at some trends here in a little bit, but as long as people are worried about losing their jobs or have already lost a job, it's likely that people are not going to spend as much, and that continues the economic downturn. Positive note, financial markets have stabilized considerably and are improving. The stock market is off of its low from March of 2009. It hit a low point of about 7,500 and has since rebounded to about 11,000. Federal stimulus funds are flowing, and we are seeing some improvement in the housing market. Not substantial, but some signs of life out there, which is encouraging that things are getting a bit better. Another slide from last year. This is from the UCSB forecast back when Bill Watkins did it. This is from 2 years ago, when he was discussing what is the recovery going to look like, and it appears as if he was correct a couple years ago. The lower right corner, at that point in time, he thought was the most likely that we would have a significant drop and then it would be a long, slow recovery where we would hover along the bottom for a considerable time before things pick up at a moderate to slow pace. The question at this point is, where are we on that continuum? Are we still at the trough or are we starting to pick up? And that is the big question at this point in time. Let's jump to the heart of the issue. This is a slide as well that we've looked at in the past, but it's a good reminder of how far we've come and yet how much further we have to go. A little hard to read, I apologize for that, but the green bars to the left between 2007 and through end of 2008 represent the subprime mortgages. During that time frame, it hit a peak of $35 billion of subprime mortgages that were coming due on a monthly basis. And we all know those problems. Folks could not afford those loans when they were coming up. Interest rates were popping after the initial lock period came up, and that drove us into the situation we are today. That's tapered off around 2009. And then where things jumped back up in 2010 and last through all of 2011 for this chart are the adjustable rate mortgages. And this relates to the folks that during the peak of the market in 05, 06, when prices were at an all-time high, folks locked into a five-year rate that then will expire right about now and through 10th, 2011. And in most cases, those interest rates are jumping up from what the initial lock is, more or less a teaser rate in many cases. Folks are having a challenge meeting that increased payment, and hence it's adding pressure to the housing market with additional foreclosures. So just a reminder that we're only partway through this. It's going to be at least through 2011 before, as a country, we work our way through these mortgages that really should not have been made. Key trends we'll look at here. Unemployment. You can see here the San Luis Obispo County and the nation are pretty close to one another, hovering around the 10%, jumping between 9 and 10%. California as a whole is considerably worse at around 12 to 13%. That's largely related to the construction business. California had one of the biggest housing booms and since has had one of the biggest busts. A couple data points that are of interest related to unemployment. The UCLA Anderson forecast projects that it will be at least 2016 before unemployment drops to 6 or 7%, which would be considered a more historical norm. So at least 6 years from their standpoint. Gross domestic product, or GDP, which is forecast to grow by about 2.5% in the upcoming year, it would have to grow at twice that rate in order to reduce unemployment by 1%. So considerable obstacles. The amount of jobs that were lost during this recession were considerable, and it will take a long time to add those back. So we do have some good news. It's not all terrible. You can see here the Great Recession is over. According to the National Bureau of Economic Research, the organization that is chartered with declaring such things determined that the Great Recession, which began in 07, ended in June of 09. I think this next slide captures the more practical ramifications of that declaration, in that we're at the bottom, and we've not come up off the bottom at this point in time. In fairness to the National Bureau of Economic Research, what they do is they look and analyze a significant amount of economic data, and they look for when the expansion reaches its peak, and then when it starts to dip, that is when a recession begins, and then when it hits the bottom and starts to expand, that is the definition of a recession. From a purely technical standpoint, they're stating that there was some expansion beginning in June of 09, and that's why they've declared that the recession is over. They do recognize from a practical standpoint we have not moved much off of the bottom. It's of little day-to-day support, if you will, that we're no longer in a recession. But technically it's over. Whether or not we enter a new one remains to be seen. One of the big questions that is out there is the federal stimulus working or not? Well, a few data points. Gross domestic product has increased. And a few of the popular programs, the cash for clunkers and the homebuyer credit, they did stimulate the market. Demand for autos did increase significantly when that program was in place. And towards the end of the federal home buyer credit program, which was March of this year, there was a jump in the housing market. Since that's expired, both those programs have expired, auto sales have dropped, and the housing market has eased a bit. So the good news is that the stimuli did work. The bad news is it may not be sticking. Additionally, the Fed has worked to keep interest rates at historically low levels. How long this continues remains to be seen as well. So the big question for the federal government at this point in time is what to do with the economy. There are a couple schools of thought. One is that the federal government needs to continue to intervene and introduce additional stimuli, that the market is not strong enough to support itself. There's another school of thought that believes the government should start backing out and start dealing with its debt issues and let the market take care of itself. It's obviously a rather large philosophical as well as political divide that needs to be overcome. The key takeaway is that the U.S. standard of living has been and continues to decline. We lived beyond our collective means for a quarter of a century. That debt bubble burst with the housing market in 05, 06. And what we're seeing now is high unemployment and that those who do have jobs are generally working harder for less. So these are difficult times, to say the least. I will talk about the details of the state budget in more detail later, but in terms of what to expect for purposes of our forecast, I think this next slide more or less just captures where the state is at and that there's little in the way of hope from the state anytime soon. Let's jump to local conditions here in San Luis Obispo County. Similar slide again to this as last year. We've not seen a lot of change. Lower end of the housing market, that in San Luis Obispo County is basically the $300,000 to $400,000 range, has improved. And the mid and high end is still slow, but here in the last 2 to 3 months is showing some improvement, which is encouraging. Consumer spending remains flat, and obviously the state budget remains a concern. How are we looking at property tax-wise? You can see here, these are the 10 counties in which we will be comparing ourselves. Ms. Douglas Schatz will be speaking to that in the next presentation, but this is our world of comparators, if you will, our 10 counties. You can see Placer County had the biggest loss of about minus 6%. Kern saw the biggest increase of about 4.5%. We're right around at the midpoint of just, we reduced the assessed value dropped by 0.9%, and the California average was just under 2% for this past year. That is as the assessed values as of January 1st, 2010. The assessment rolls were just completed in June 2010, and this is what's in place for the 10-11 budget year.
Dan, what does that equate to in dollars?
1% drop is about $850,000 for the county in terms of property tax. Take a look at the building industry. Going back, this was a 10-year chart back in 07, 08. We've just continued to add to it. That's why it's a 12-year chart now. These are actual numbers, not budget, not forecast, but actual figures. The orange line represents number of permits. The blue line, the construction value. You can see we are now below where we were 12 years ago, and that the gains have dropped considerably in terms of the amount of building occurring. We're actually at 20% below where we were in 97, 98, and we're down over 50% from the peak in the 04, 05, 03, 04 time frame. Another local indicator that we've watched and we've reported to your board on a regular basis is foreclosure trends. These are data that comes from our clerk recorder's office. You can see here the orange line is the notice of default, which is the beginning of the foreclosure process. That's when a homeowner or property owner receives a notice that they're falling behind. The trustee's deed is the end of the process when the actual foreclosure occurs. From 05-06, which is more or less the last of the good years, you can see notices of default are up 343% from 511 to 2,263, and actual foreclosures are up from 48 to 1,555, which is a 3,140% increase over that four-year time frame. It's really quite incredible. Another trend that we're watching is the amount that are actually going into foreclosure. If you take a look at this last chart that we just looked at, back from 02-03 to 06-07, it's fairly tight. And then in 06-07, 07-08, the notice of default increased considerably, as did the trustees' deed, but a lot of people were able to avoid foreclosure. If you look at this chart, back in 05-06, only about 10% of homes or property owners that received a notice of default actually went into foreclosure. They were able to avoid it either by getting a new job and making their payments, selling their home, securing some other type of financing, whatever the case may be. Now we're looking at almost 70% of those that receive a notice are going into foreclosure, which means that people are strained. They're not able to, the options are not there in order to avoid foreclosure like they were in the past. So obviously a concern that we're watching closely as well. So, let's jump into the actual forecast for San Luis Obispo. Same methodology in prior years. It's very intentional so that we have an apples-to-apples comparison. More or less, it assumes that we continue to do what we do. We don't add anything in the current year or in 11-12. If we do, and if the resources were added without funding, it would add to the gap that we'll be discussing. First half of the equation is the revenue side of the equation. three main components of revenue. There's non-departmental revenue, which can be spent on just about anything. There is departmental revenue, which is generally restricted to specific programs and services. And then there's fund balance available, which is money that's left over at the end of one year that can be used for the next year, and that is discretionary, much like non-departmental revenue. Total revenue down about 2%. You can see non-departmental basically flat. A small decrease is forecast. The big driver of that is secured property tax. Makes up most of non-departmental revenue. We're projecting relatively flat at down about 0.3%. Sales tax and the bed tax or transient occupancy tax, relatively flat as well, though we have seen signs of life for a few months. It'll pick up and then it drops back down. So unsure of where that's headed other than it appears to be generally flat. Departmental revenue down about 3.5%, again, generally flat. Federal stimulus funding is expiring. That was received in 09, 10, and 10, 11. The number's down the percentage a little more than it would be otherwise. We're assuming repayment of the Los Osos wastewater project loan during 10, 11, which drops departmental revenue more than what it would be otherwise because we don't budget for it in 11, 12. It's really an accounting issue. It will be reflected by an increased fund balance available on the flip side. So the net effect is a wash as far as the overall budget, the impact of the loan repayment. Jumping to the other side of the equation, expenditures, more or less flat. We're assuming no increase for salary and benefits for this upcoming year. Just to illustrate what a 1% increase for all employees would mean, it's about $2.25 million. So to the extent that any increases are received, it would add to the gap that we're discussing today. We don't yet have numbers from the pension trust for what future rates will look like. We'll receive those sometime between spring and summer of 2011, but for now we're forecasting a 1% increase. And then pension obligation bond, the rate is increasing or forecast increase about 0.5%. This is one of the unintended consequences of the financial situation. The pension obligation was bonds were used to finance a portion of VAC, I believe, in 04, 05 or 03, 04. The debt service is locked in, but we charge it out as a percentage of payroll. Well, since then payroll has been reduced by about 10%, the cost per employee, if you will, to department goes up in order to make the debt service whole in that time frame. Continue with the salary and benefits piece, it adjusts for any variances between what was assumed in 10-11 and what actually occurred. And it also assumes that the lowered workers' compensation rates will remain in effect. We lowered those about 50% due to reduced program costs, and risk management has largely driven that program. We're assuming that can continue through 11-12, possibly beyond, but we'll have to wait and see. We'll have some updated numbers on that in the next few months. Fairly basic approach to non-salary, a 1% CPI. Cost of living has been relatively flat. And assuming a 4% contingency, general board policy is a 5% contingency. It was intentionally lowered starting in 09-10, and we've kept it at 4% since that time. The bottom line, about a $9 million gap, could be in the range, as Mr. Grant noted earlier, of $9 to $15 million. The reason the range swings a little higher is that revenues, we think we forecasted more or less a midpoint. Expenditures, given that we assume nothing for prevailing wage increases and compensation and a relatively small CPI, is likely to be to the lower end of the range on the expenditure side of the equation, not to the midpoint. There's a little bit of a difference in methodology this year as compared to prior years. To illustrate what the variance looks like, you can see here a mere 1% change in assumptions would impact the forecast anywhere from about $1.5 million to $2.2 million. So as far as the summary of the forecast portion before I go into the budget balancing strategies is that we are seeing some improvement. It's not all doom and gloom out there, but we think we're going to continue to hover near the bottom for the next year. Consumer weakness is likely to remain weak as long as unemployment remains high. There is obviously still a chance of a double dip and going back into another recession. More recently, there's less talk and concern of a double dip as compared to about 6 months ago, so hopefully we've moved past that, but it's not certain. And then inflation is still a concern in the out years with the national debt as high as it is, the federal budget gap as high as it is. Money's coming cheap these days, and that's never bodes well for inflation, which means for us we're looking at at least 3 more years of additional budget. And again, the good news is that the budget gap is shrinking, but they will still be difficult in the out years. Before I roll into budget balancing strategies and plans, are there any questions about this?
Mr. Hill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan, I wanted to, on A24, you make the statement that, this is in the second paragraph, many in the real estate industry believe it will be at least 3 years before the housing market returns to more historically normal levels. What do we consider that to be? If we look at, you know, the chart you provided, P2, which showed for a period of, gosh, maybe 8 or 9 years on average a 10% increase in total assessed property values every year, which I can't imagine would ever return. So when we talk about historically normal, what would you assess that to be?
Yeah, that's a good question. More in lines of the 2 to 3% range. You know, maybe a jump up to 5% every once in a while, depending upon the market. But if we, you're right, the ten-year chart isn't as reflective as it used to be because it's now capturing the boom and now the bust. If we were to go back another 10 to 15 years prior to that, it would be more along the lines of the 2 to 3 to 4% range.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Okay. So let's roll into the budget balancing strategies. So as we're all aware, 11-12 is the fourth year of the five-year pain plan that we've been working on for some time. The good news, again, as you can see here, the budget balancing strategies are working. The gap, we hit a high point of $30 million in 2009-10. That did fall in line with prior forecasts. We've since cut it by about 40% in 10-11, and we're forecasting to cut it again, hopefully by about 40% in 11-12. So the good news is that plans are working and that we're in the fourth year of the five-year pain plan. The bad news is that we think it's going to be more along the lines of the seven-year plan as opposed to a five-year plan. And the reason for that is the revenue growth is not as strong as what we thought. 3 years ago when the five-year plan was put into place, we thought by 11-12 we would start seeing revenue growth, and as we just reviewed, we're actually seeing a bit of a drop. The law of numbers comes into play on this, and it's 40% of our budget is funded by the federal and state budget. I don't think that we should be anticipating any significant increases there anytime soon. The next biggest driver of our budget on the revenue side is property tax, accounts for 20%. As we just reviewed, that's more likely to be flat. In addition, property tax revenues are really a laggard in the business cycle. The way it works for the upcoming year, for 11-12, the assessed value that will be worked on by the assessor's office that's in place of January 1, 2011, would be in effect for the fiscal year 11-12, which means it would be in place essentially through June of 2012, almost 18 months out. So as the market increases, we have a lag before we realize that in property taxes. So it will be a few more years. And that's the biggest driver for why we've spread out the plan, if you will, to 7 years. On the flip side, we did have good news, as Mr. Grant alluded to earlier. Departments did a good job of managing their budgets, freed up additional fund balance available last year that we put into reserves to help replenish some of our short-term reserves and options. So we do have some unplanned additional short-term money that can be used to help soften the impact. Obviously, an option would be to stick with the five-year plan and close the gap in the next year or so. That would entail more cuts to programs and services than what was previously anticipated, so it's recommended that we spread that out, continue to use some of the short-term options over a couple more years in order to help mitigate the amount of program and service level reductions that would otherwise be needed. Again, you can see here, just to illustrate, the approach is to pare down or funnel down the amount of the short-term options. In 10-11, we had a $17 million gap. About a quarter of that was closed with short-term options. Three-quarters was closed with ongoing budget reductions that address the structural gap. The goal is by 13-14 to reduce that to a 10%, 90% split and then be at our new normal, if you will, in 2014 and 15. Talk a little bit about one of the challenges. We reviewed this in the past, but it's worth revisiting because the dynamic is continuing. Basic framework is that any department has departmental revenue, less their expense. The difference is offset with general fund support, and that's by design. That's where our general discretionary revenue goes to help fund that difference. Again, as mentioned earlier, that bottom line general fund support is funded by non-departmental revenue and FBA, less the general fund contingency that comes off the top. The challenge that we find ourselves, you can see here, back in 07-08, just 3 years ago, a little more than a third of the general fund support went to the four public safety departments. And you can see what health agencies, social services, and roads are called out there. They're the next biggest buckets. The other 15 departments comprised about 40% of the bottom line general fund support back in 07-08. We jump forward to where we're at in the 10-11 budget. Public safety has grown to almost half of the bottom line general fund support. The other 15 departments have dropped to 32%. So the challenges before us is that public safety is obviously one of your board's highest priorities. Staff will continue to work towards fulfilling those priorities and those stated goals. But the challenge is that as public safety takes up a bigger portion of discretionary revenue, it's going to become more and more difficult to budget, to balance the overall budget on the backs of the other departments. And one of the implications is that public safety may have to participate to a little greater extent than what's been done in the past. Otherwise, more severe cuts would be required in other parts of the organization. Just to hit on our budget balancing approaches, nothing new here. It's what we've been doing for the last few years and are recommending that we continue. Obviously, we have a seven-year, multi-year approach and that we're carefully using our short-term options. Long-term options that staff will build a budget that is in line with your board's stated priorities, that all departments participate, nobody's exempt. Obviously, we do not take an across-the-board approach. Some departments have had to make bigger cuts than others based upon priorities as well as demands for services and individual departmental revenue situations. That we'll make mid-year reductions as necessary. We've done that the last few years, and we may have to do it again once the state budget details move forward. And then obviously, given that labor costs comprise about 60% of the overall budget, we're working closely with our various employee associations. Short term, we've now had a hiring chill, if you will, in place for 3 years. All hiring requests must be approved personally by the county administrator. We've reduced the general fund contingency from 5% to 4%. We're deferring various projects, both on the capital and automation side, and we've reallocated some of the accumulated depreciation for future use to help balance the budget. We've utilized voluntary time off rather extensively the last few years. This has been in lieu of mandatory time off or required furloughs. Those are obviously something we can consider down the road if things become more difficult, but at this point we're recommending to continue with voluntary furloughs. We utilize federal stimulus funding to the extent we can, but again, that'll be running out here at the end of 10-11 in most cases. And then we'll utilize one-time reserves. So to revisit, your board's priorities are to meet legal mandates, meet our debt service requirements so that we can access the bond markets in the future. We want to keep our creditors whole and keep our credit rating high. And public safety, then, is your board's third highest priority, defined by these four departments that you can see here. And to conclude this portion of the presentation, I do have more on the state budget, but we are asking that your board, similar to prior years, direct departments to incorporate, I do want to emphasize, prioritize reductions into the 11-12 submittal. That provide any direction to staff regarding your board's priorities, any changes beyond what was listed here, and that we continue along with the plan that we've put in place for the last few years in order to address the 11-12 budget gap.
Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Buckshire, to a comment and a question regarding your recommendations. The first one is to direct departments to incorporate prioritized reductions. I think, you know, the strategy, as you pointed out, the five-year pain plan that we're expanding to a seven out of necessity, in that prioritization reduction that you're asking all department heads to submit with their budgets to give us some options, basically. I think it's very important that they articulate the impact that those reductions will have on services countywide, if they would include that in their list of recommended reductions. Tell us specifically what impact that would have in terms of services to the public and reducing staffing. And also, we do have a number of reserve accounts, and we've used a lot of those in our strategy for short-term reductions, deferring capital improvements, minimizing building maintenance, not contributing to various funds. And we've been able, when we initially looked at that strategy, we had enough in those reserve accounts to continue doing what we have been doing. And I'm curious to know, are we reaching to the point in those reserves where we will no longer be able to invest in technology improvements, invest in the various other accounts that we've reduced our contributions to?
That's a good question. I mean, certainly reallocating some of that funding has reduced our ability to deal with some future capital projects and automation, but we do believe there are still adequate reserves to deal with the needs for the next few years within reason, according to the capital project plan and automation plan. But, you know, there are some big projects out there that are really expensive. For example, one is the property tax system. It's a really old system. It's one we've wrestled with, and the price tag is quite high potentially to deal with that. And so we've kind of put that off because we don't really have the funds currently. But setting particular examples like that aside, the general answer is yes, we do believe that we can continue with the plan we have in place, that we've been able to maintain the percentage of reserves of the overall county budget that's required and per industry standards to maintain a relatively high bond rating so we can access bond markets, and the reserves are there to offer a cushion and additional downturns and then to also help fund some of the automation and capital projects.
Yeah, I might add, Jim Grant, County Administrator, that even though we are not putting as much money into those accounts, we are able to at least fund a portion of those accounts each year, and we have. And they have some balances in there. So we have not cut out all the automation projects. We are working on automation projects. We are working on capital projects. We do have a healthy maintenance budget for our buildings. So we haven't stopped doing that. We've reduced that. We certainly would like to build up those reserves and be able to afford those higher-priced items that we need to work on in the future. But I just want to make a point that we have not stopped doing those things. We are still maintaining, we're still building, we're still doing the things we need to do, so we're in fairly decent shape. We just have to be careful of how we allocate those dollars.
Thank you.
I think too, that the point being is that if we don't keep putting money aside for this, the cost when the time comes is going to be pretty phenomenal. Mr. Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan, you brought up the issue of the public safety priorities and budgeting and how we might have to look at it at some point. If you could remind me where we are in terms, is it that the public safety fund centers are held, have some room above status quo from other departments, and how much? And I know in the past there has been the prevailing wage increases. I think perhaps they've been exempt from having to absorb that, or maybe not, but we're not looking at that in the future. So if you could just elaborate on that.
Yeah, the challenge has been the last couple years is that a status quo budget, just to revisit how the process works, is departments submit, all operating departments, what they need in terms to continue doing what they're doing, if you will, and that includes any cost of living increases, includes other inflationary increases, includes any decreases in revenue that then puts pressure on the bottom line for general fund support. So that's ultimately how the target is of what they believe they need to continue to do what they're doing. In the past couple years, the departments that fell into the all other category, the 15 departments, have taken about 5% cut. Again, it's not across the board for everybody, but on average, that's about what it's worked out to. Public safety, by comparison, is still grown by anywhere from 2 to 3 or 4% in terms of general fund support. Now, it's still a cut because they're not receiving as much general fund support as what they need to maintain the status quo. You know, a number of positions have been eliminated from the Sheriff's Department, from Probation Department. And that's exacerbated because some of the revenues in public safety have come in considerably short. Prop 172, the VLF realignment revenue, and that puts the pressure on the general fund support. So public safety certainly has participated in the cuts. The unfortunate reality is they comprise so much of the general fund that even though they've they've grown. It's just not, it's been as much as what they would have requested to grow, which means that others have had to cut even more.
And we do have, I'm assuming, a historical sense of that growth in public safety, and now that has shrunk, as you're saying, even as they grow, it's still below their status quo. I mean,
that's,
I guess...
That's correct, yeah.
In the better years, they were able to grow at a greater percentage above status quo.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just following along on that, in prior years, as you asked departments to come up with their prioritized potential expenditure reductions, you had them go to 5% below or 10% below. Are we looking at that same exercise at about that same level?
Yeah, I need to refine that analysis a bit, but I would imagine it'll be somewhere in that same ballpark. We typically try to ask for a little bit more than what's required just because we don't know what's going to occur at the state. We don't want to have to go back and ask again, but I would say at this point in time, asking for a minus 5% is probably in the ballpark.
Okay. And then going back to your funneling down of one-time versus versus long-term cuts and extending this out over 10 years. I'm looking at the bottom of A213 where, you know, we're talking about reducing the number one time. Certainly the depreciation accounts and the maintenance accounts and the automation replacement accounts are all places, but we also have the tax reduction reserve that in my recollection we have planned to use, but over the last couple of years we actually haven't had to use or haven't had to use as much because of good news, like fund balance available popping up. So I guess the question was, and it's not on A13, you have the percentage, planned percentages going down, but on one of your slides you also have the expected gap. I will not hold you to those numbers, but, well, I might later, but, you know, we'll see later. But have you costed that out? I mean, have we looked at what, you know, what we have in reserve relative to what we expect to need to do as we taper it down? Because, and my point, where I'm going with that is that, especially in the health and human services area, I think we need to keep our eyes open, our ears open to the fact that, as previous CAO used to say, we're a bit in the misery business, in the sense that as things get difficult in the outside economy, people turn to government services and local government services for support. And so I'm interested in a very clear picture of what we have to buffer, especially our health and human services side, because you know, this county's been managed financially very well for a very long time, and those reserves are there in part to buffer the very situation of difficult times. So I was curious as to how that analysis might proceed.
Let me take that for just a moment here. I see somewhat of a difficult issue when we start talking about the health and human services side and then backfilling with reserves. As you know, the health and human services are primarily funded by state and federal revenue. And when those revenue sources dry up, or at least they're reduced, then over the last number of years, or actually quite a few years back as far as I can remember, when those revenues start to shrink, the program shrank itself. They're tied to those dollars, tied to those programs. Those dollars leave at the state or federal revenue level, then those programs shrink. If we were to utilize what I would term local reserves to backfill those, we're going down a fairly slippery slope here, because we will never get those monies back, presumably, from the state and federal government. So now we're funding more of those state and federal programs and those mandates with general fund money. That means less for all other departments, including your public safety and all the other departments, in fact. So I think it exacerbates our problem if we go down that road. And part of the recommendation, at least what I will make, is that we don't do that. And it's up to your board. If you want to backfill, you certainly, this is your budget, but as your basically financial advisor, I'm going to say that I'm going to recommend that we don't do that at this point in time.
And let me tell you where I was going with that. I certainly understand. I support the idea that, unfortunately, we need to reduce our overmatch. There's a question of how much we reduce it and over what period of time we reduce it. The other question is that so many of the health and human services programs have an interface with our public safety, and I'm have been one to try to expand the concept of public safety toward a more preventative approach. And so I think the board, from my perspective, I'd like our board to be aware of the possibility of a good investment in a health program. You know, you can think of the obvious addiction programs, support for foster youth, whatever those things are, and each has its own overmatch issue there. But I'd like us to keep alert to the opportunity to invest in a preventative program that could help our public safety. A couple other just quick questions. Do we have a list of deferred maintenance, especially in terms of buildings? Did I remember seeing that as part of our capital improvement plan?
That is available, yes. I don't believe we published it in the budget book. What we have been doing is, during the good times, a number of projects were funded, and there's a backlog. There is basically more projects, and there's were staff to do that. So one of the strategies has been to work through that backlog and not tie up new funding with projects that would just go sit on the backlog list.
I mean, deferred maintenance is one of those things where, again, as long as we're being mindful about it, I think it's a place where we can cut in order to, I mean, we can cut on maintenance in order to bridge
better. If I could add to that just very quickly, the process, just to illustrate a little further, is each year the General Services Agency, in conjunction with our office, has asked departments for any requests for new capital or maintenance, and also the maintenance folks of General Services Agency goes out and does an assessment of facilities and compiles that list, and we look at what really needs to be urgently done to avoid, you know, significant deterioration of facilities, and some of those do get funded and get put to the higher list.
We have our safety issues.
Correct.
Organizational development, we've reduced or eliminated general fund support, but we have reserves to fund some of that, don't we? Because, again, I'm thinking in terms of the efficiency and the development of our employees and our ability. Are we planning to come out of reserves on that instead of general funds?
Yeah, we have sufficient reserves for another few years in that area, and we'll take a look at it. We have used reserves over the last 2 or 3 years. We'll probably do it again in one more year, and then we're going to have to start looking at making sure we actually fund it from a general fund contribution. Once we climb out of this hole, I think we'll want to start funding it again.
Okay. And then two quick questions about the state budget. You'd indicate it's been very recently passed. It's going to take some time to know what the impacts of the budget just passed are going to be. Do we have a sense of when that's going to happen? And the second question is, do we have a sense of when the budget's going to blow up next year? Because it's widely understood that the solutions proposed this year aren't going to last very far into the term of the next legislature.
Yeah, Dan can speak to that right now if you would like to talk about the state budget. We think that it's just a patch right now. Probably January, February next year, state will be right back at it. They're going to realize that their budget was a gimmick, and they're going to have a huge gap again still.
I think it'll happen right after the new governor takes the oath of office. They'll hand them the grenade.
Yeah.
Okay.
If there are any other questions before I go into the state budget, if I get your board to take action on staff's recommendations.
Yeah. I do have a couple more board members with questions here as well.
This is the second before we institute a no running rule in chambers. I'm worried about Mr. Greening's.
I hate to see you take a header
at the podium. We'll be there for you, Eric.
I forgot what I was going to ask going that direction, so I'll go to Mistress. I know. What I wanted to, I think for the listening audience and those that are watching, and I'm amazed at those that do listen and watch, it might be good to explain the difference between the reserves, because I think, as been mentioned before, there's quite a large number of dollars out there that are in reserves, but these are not discretionary for the most part. So could you just briefly comment on that?
Yeah, if we could actually put a PowerPoint. I have some slides to that effect here. Run through what that looks like. In total, we have, I think it's about $72 million of reserves. As you can see here, about $18 million is restricted in use. It cannot be used for discretionary purposes. For, you know, traffic impact fees must be used related to new growth of new projects. Wildlife and grazing, that whopping $4,500 must be used on wildlife and grazing. It can't be used elsewhere. The biggest bucket is in the specified use. Much of this could be reallocated, but it but it has been planned for these projects, as you can see here. We had the recently approved juvenile hall project. There's a local county map that $2.75 million needs to go to that. Otherwise, we couldn't proceed with the project. Willow Road, $6 million was carved out. And you can see we do have some money, about $9 million for automation projects coming down the pipeline, as well as some funding here for fire equipment. Obviously, we could reallocate that, but it means we wouldn't have adequate funding to support future fire equipment replacement, which would be problematic. So that's where the bulk of the reserves are. And then the last piece, as we referenced earlier, is about $5.5 million in the tax reduction reserve. And that is completely discretionary, and it was set up for this very purpose, to help with a rainy day, to help mitigate some of the offsets. In addition, in about 6 weeks or so, the airport will be bringing an item back to your board to discuss the capital projects. And as your board recalls, there was $9.25 million that was carved out of the tax reduction reserve allocated to the airport for a new terminal for a new parking structure, and then to help with cash flow purposes for a new terminal design. They'll be coming back to your board with options for moving forward, given the changes in the economic climate, to scale back the parking structure, give an update on the new terminal design, and then hopefully to free up some of that money to put back into this reserve. More on that to come here in the next month or so.
Thank you. Mr. Sajjan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to public safety, my estimation that we are below status quo, not just because of the facts that you bring forward, but also that our population has grown. So we don't have officers for so many residents of our area. And what concerns me that even though we're very good compared to other counties that surround us and other communities that surround our county, you see much more gang-related violence and drug-related violence that goes on, that sooner or later does impact that flow into our county without necessarily pointing finger to nearby cities. That scares me that if we're not, for myself, the priority does go to public safety, because later on to play catch-up is going to be much more expensive, much less of a pleasurable place to live in our county.
Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to return real briefly to Mr. Gibson's comments, and sort of touches on what Mr. Patterson was recommending too, which is, I think if, and I understand exactly what Mr. Grant's talking about on making sure that we spend money not just wisely, but in a way that's, that's going to sort of be replenished on some of the health and human services. But it seems that if we restrict all of our decisions to just the mere economic calculus, it's kind of short-sighted, and it tends to be just, crassly utilitarian. And I think it would be helpful. I mean, I don't think the budget should just be an accumulation of numbers. It needs to be, to some extent, a moral document, and it needs to reflect a far-sighted sense of things. And I think it would be useful to have, when Mr. Patterson talked about what some of these cuts in services and programs, what they would be, I think it would be useful if Mr. Hamm and Mr. Collins, who really represent the departments that deal with health and human services, had conversations with Mr. Salio and Mr. Shea and the next sheriff to talk about, what sort of cuts might in fact be the sorts that end up worsening problems, or the programs that could be fortified are the kinds of things that would lead to better prevention, and certainly underscoring our commitment to safe communities. But I do think that it's a worthwhile thing to engage in, because, in this time, I know it's really popular for everybody just to say, cut everything and don't do anything. But there are certain things that, that we need to do and that we should do, and there are certain discussions, I think, that we would be useful to have. And that's just my sense of that. I really do think that it would be useful. And, maybe it turns out that there's no backfilling that would be useful. I don't know. Or maybe there's specified use reserves that we might make different decisions on. I myself probably have less love for parking lots than programs that help, kids at risk and things like that. So, comments on that.
Okay. I'm going to go to the public, then we'll come back. Andy Caldwell, followed by Eric Greening.
You can walk. There you go. Good morning.
Chairman Meacham, members of the board, I'm Andy Caldwell representing CoLab, and for the past 20 years, I've served as a local government watchdog and business advocate. Back in 1991, California was suffering from a recession, and a report was commissioned with Peter Huberoth as the head, and they studied the California economy and the business climate, and they concluded that California was not suffering from a recession as much as it was suffering from self-inflicted blows to our own economy by our own government, proverbially shooting ourselves in the foot. And, you know, we've just sat through an hour and a half or so of presentation, and it was an excellent presentation as far as it went, but not once did you mention the tax climate, the regulatory climate, and the permitting process that would allow our economy to recover. It's as if there's nothing you can do to help the business community recover. CEQA's not on the table, CARB's not on the table, AB 32, SB 375. There's nothing you can do. There's no way you can do business different in this county to help the housing market recover, to help manufacturing and industry grow, to help businesses locate here or grow here if they have the capacity to do so. You can't streamline the permitting process. You can't change the values of your policies. You're going to just think you're going to keep eking through this recession when in reality California was in debt before the recession started. The state of California was already on the scale of fiscal oblivion when the rest of this nation's economy was booming. Have you forgotten that? We have it. There's things you could be doing right now, including eliminating some of your land use policies that are going to further undermine the property tax base. 90% of your revenues, your local discretionary revenues, come from property taxes. So if you are anti-growth and anti-private property, there's no wonder you're broke. Not one word has been spoken here today about the supply side of your problem. Why is that? Most of this county is undeveloped, and yet you're spending millions of dollars this year to make sure it never gets developed, and then you wonder why it's broke.
Thank you, Mr. Caldwell. Mr. Greening, and followed by Jeff Bard.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and the first thing I would ask is before you have any more conversation or come close to anything resembling a decision that you permit Mr. Buckshy to complete his presentation relative to the state budget. That's an absolutely essential part of the context for any decision, and I would have welcomed it before this opened to the public or before we started having discussions about overmatches and so on. With what are we over or under matching? I think the more we can understand that, and maybe it will be an emerging understanding, but it is essential context. I welcome the discussion of a broader view of what constitutes public safety. I'd like to thank Mr. Gibson for bringing it up and the other supervisors who are tagging on. I think we need to take that broad view, and I've been advocating it for some time relative to health and human services. These departments save lives. That's public safety. I think to some extent I agree with the concept of the conversation among departments. However, if our budget is going to be a moral document, there's one direction we shouldn't go. We should not assume that the people most worthy of receiving health and human services are those who would otherwise be most likely to commit crimes. This is not about a protection racket. This is about serving human beings, whether they constitute a present danger to us or not. And so, even if those conversations take place, to keep this a moral document,
Let's make sure that all people in need, whether we feel threatened by what they might or might not do, if their needs are met or not met, that all people in need are equally worthy of having their needs met. The final issue I'd like to bring up, I know Mr. Caldwell brought up a supply side from an economic standpoint. I would like to look at the supply side from a different standpoint. The rough economy may or may not recover. It will recover in a different way than it has before. One of what's happening, in addition to bad decisions that were made in strictly economic fields, a lot of what's happening is also a symptom of ecological overshoot, not just on a local, but on a global scale, and on the inability of the economy. We could print money till doomsday. It would not change the productive capacity of the soil, the ocean, or anything else we depend on. And so let's remember the real foundation of the economy is the ecosystem, and we're going to have a recovery plan that recovers the ecosystem. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bard?
We need new revenue sources for county government. Whatever you think of Prop 13, one of the downsides is that power has devolved to Sacramento, and we have difficulty funding public safety. So how are we going to address the shortfall? Money's got to come from somewhere. We need new revenue sources, and among these, I'd like to remind us, alternative energy, high-tech pioneering, such as the solar power projects that hopefully will come online and enhance our revenue. Hopefully some R&D can move to this county as a result of these projects as they go forward. Secondly, I hope the board will seriously consider supporting an oil severance tax. We have oil severance tax in other oil-producing states. Why not California? Maybe, 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 someday we will obtain revenue from marijuana. Right now, it is a revenue loss because it costs money to send sheriff's deputies out chasing down these farms, and I'm not saying they shouldn't be doing that now, but maybe the day will come where we can structure a way to address the public safety concerns and pull some revenue out of that product. Because somebody's getting revenue out of it right now, and it sure is not the county. Real property revenues will be enhanced by historical preservation, and I did not support the terrible historical preservation ordinance that the city tried to put through in the form that it was conceived. Nevertheless, by preserving our architectural heritage, we will preserve the attractiveness of the county both as a site for tourist spending and also a site for corporate relocation. And to that end, I personally am voting on Measure H and seriously reconsidering it because there are some very attractive farmhouses along Broad that we will lose if the Prado Road extension goes through there. And personally, I'm thinking, and this is, I realize that's not county jurisdiction per se, but county has perhaps an advisory role to play. Perhaps the COG has an advisory role to play, with all due deference to my friend Eric Greening. And basically, if we can preserve these quaint farmhouses, more folks are going to drive out. So why don't we get more commercial frontage by routing south of Damian Garcia? Okay, smart agricultural practices, including our vintners. I just was lucky to attend 10-10-10 and learned a lot about smart agriculture, and we can, I think, be at the cutting edge of developing new agricultural methods that minimize the use of methyl bromate and all that other nasty stuff. Regarding meeting our housing element, we'll have the benefit of increasing the housing assessment base. And I would like to point out that subprime mortgages aren't necessarily always bad. It's the NIVs and the ARMs. Regarding expense control, the sheriff's alternatives to incarceration will help. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the public portion. I got just a couple comments I wanted to make relative to Mr. Caldwell's questions about what are we doing? Are we sitting here doing nothing? And I would submit to you that we are on our way. Supervisor Hill and I have headed up the first economic strategy for the San Luis County that will roll out in November, which I think will add a tremendous amount of opportunity and value to our businesses. Over the last 6 months, we've met with over 150 of our business executives throughout the county to find out
what it is that we need to do to try to stimulate our economy as we progress down the road. The second part of that is what we're doing is next week, as a matter of fact, will be we've established what we call our process improvement committees. There's two different committees that will be heading up a discussion about how can we improve our process to allow for businesses to be more successful and to get them through on these tough times and position ourselves down the road. So we're not sitting on our hands. There are things in the works. Mr. Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You actually said exactly what I want. And I usually don't like to reply to public comment, but the theatrical bombast of Mr. Caldwell called for it, and I think that providing him some more education on what he's clearly ignorant on in terms of what the board's been doing, as you just pointed out, has great importance, and we'll see more of it, I think, publicized, as you say, after the November 5th economic forecast, where the economic development strategy will first be unveiled, and then thereafter there'll be a lot of other efforts in implementation. And I think this has been, as you and I know, having attended a lot of the cluster meetings, there's a great amount of excitement and momentum in the business community and appreciation that the Board of Supervisors is involved in this.
Mr. Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Supervisor Meacham. I, too often, Andy Caldwell gets up and makes these unfounded statements, basically, and I wanted to make sure that we responded this time. We don't always, but the listening audience doesn't always know that we are doing things specifically, and I wanted to point out what both you and Supervisor Hill pointed out, that we've been working with the business community the past many months to develop a regional economic strategy, and hopefully we'll be successful in implementing that. Also, we meet regularly with the building community and housing advocates to improve our processes in permitting and land use policies that will allow more efficient development and housing development in our county, which is sorely needed. So we are working hard in those areas, and people that are paying attention know that.
Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't know whether you wanted to hear from Mr. Buckshy on the state budget or act on his recommendations first. I had one comment on one of the strategies.
And I was curious as to why you want to take action here rather than go to the state. We
can do either. It's really up to your board.
I'd rather go through the state briefing with that, and that may have some further input from the board.
Sure.
Did you want to...
Actually, if I could comment briefly after he's done with the state briefing.
Okay.
Pull back up the PowerPoint. Okay. The state budget, as we know, the legislature passed it late Thursday evening, early Friday morning. About an $18 billion gap, a little under $7 billion of expenditure reductions, and really the other three areas there are short-term gimmicks. They're really nothing more than that. To put it in perspective, counting on $5.5 billion of federal funding, I believe the state currently receives for these particular categories somewhere between $1.5 billion and $2 billion, so they're projecting a built into the budget a doubling of what they currently receive. Congress hasn't even taken up the issue. It's rather optimistic. Increased revenue assumptions. I don't know what it is most recently, but a little while back, I believe they built in, it was either a 7 or 9% increase in sales tax, which just seems not supportable at this point in time. And then the last category truly is loans, transfers, funding shifts, really accounting games to help close the gap. So that being said, as Mr. Grant alluded earlier, we anticipate at least a $20 billion gap come January with the new governor. And he or she will have to wrestle with that with their first proposed budget to the legislature in January. Governor did veto about $1 billion, and it comes from the Health and Human Services area. CalWORKs and subsidized child care are both, those are both related to the CalWORKs program. Don't have the details on what that means yet in terms of the impact to our county budget or more likely to the residents of this county and obviously statewide who rely on those programs. We'll work through that and report back to your board. And then the last piece is related to mental health services for seriously emotionally disturbed children, as they are referred to in this program. The partnership with schools, we'll have to have to see what plays out with that as well. Not a lot of detail at this point in time. Mr. Greening referenced, I believe, earlier, this was an interesting budget process this year at the state. The Big Five did meet. They kept it under tight wraps, and the legislature hammered it out behind closed doors in a day, and now we're finding out the details. A few high-level outcomes. There was agreements on Tier 2 pensions for all our employees that they are implementing rather quickly. I believe in mid-November those will take effect. The governor did push through what he considers to be budget reform to increase the budget stabilization reserve from 5% to 10%. That will require a ballot initiative. It's not yet determined when that would occur, or obviously if it would pass. And then in a nutshell, AB 1624, because the state budget has been delayed for so long, 100 days, this allows for temporary lending, most likely to come from counties, school districts, and the like, in terms of allowing the state to shore up its cash flow in the near term. Not a lot of detail. It sounds like it'll be mostly related to some of the social services programs. We will receive the payment. It's just a cash flow. It'll be delayed a couple months. If it's similar to what they proposed earlier, it should be manageable for our county. It shouldn't be too significant, but we'll have to wait and see what moves forward. Public safety, no prisoner transfer. This is something that had been discussed, that state prisoners at a certain offense level would be sent to county jails. That is not included in this budget. And then a very important point here, this would have a big impact upon us locally. As part of the 09-10 budget, the vehicle license fee, or VLF, was increased by 0.5%. That expires in June of 2011. It was not taken up in this budget. It more or less is going to be dealt with as part of the 11-12 budget. But if that tax is not extended, it would be a $2.5 million hit to our county's public safety folks, which would be significant. This funds a number of programs. And then lastly, the Williamson Act. $10 million of state general fund was added to the program for the subvention to counties. It used to be $30 million. It was eliminated in 09-10. So we got about a third back, which is surprising and is good news. I think CSAC, as well as our state lobbyists, worked hard on that to get that put back. We actually saw some results, which is nice to see. And also there is cleanup language. AB 2530 allows for an alternative means of partially funding Williamson Act subvention, given that it was reduced. A lot of detail on this. The cleanup language, which was absolutely essential, was included. And bottom line is we'll be reporting back to your board in about a month or so how this new legislation works and what our options are going forward. It is a voluntary program for counties to recoup some of the funding. And that is it in a nutshell.
Mr. Gibson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't really have any specific comment on the state budget. That's one of the wait-and-see things that we've got to deal with, and I know staff will be working hard to understand the consequences and the future consequences. I'd actually just like to comment on two topic areas. One, on A214, page 14 of the staff report, we talk about the bullet budget balancing approaches that really get to the long-term budget gap. It starts with priority-driven. The board sets priorities, as is our duty, and we're going to see response. And all departments participate, number two. I think both very important concepts. The third one I've raised for the last couple years, and that's the question of proportional reductions. I think it's okay to have that in there, but that balancing strategy suggests that those departments that have grown the fastest over recent years might be in line for the most significant cuts. I think that's one criteria to keep in mind, but I am concerned that strategy be subordinate to the basic priorities that we set out. And for instance, our planning department has taken a lot of hit on the revenue side because of the lack of building permits going forward. At the same time, it is faced with extraordinary challenges and the need to move forward on long-term planning efforts, both for resource protection and for the implementation of the smart growth policies that this board has put in place. And so simply to look at growth, which might show under a certain set of lenses, growth in the planning department that should be reversed, I would remind the board that as we participate
both here and at the regional level through SLOCOG, that there's very good reason to keep long-term planning efforts going in this county. It will be the foundation of future development on the one hand, and there are a lot of reasons for implementing more strategic growth, not the least of which is that we are faced with highly constrained revenues for infrastructure improvements, and we're going to need to be extraordinarily strategic in applying those. So, again, just trying to put these strategies in a priority order, I think our priorities are going to trump the history of growth in any particular department, although I know that that's one thing that admin staff looks at. The other topic I'd contemplate just briefly, I'll hop right over on the third rail here, and that's the question of revenue enhancements. I think it's at this point a little premature to talk about that until we see what happens at the state level. But I would note for colleagues a couple of items. Through SLOCOG, there is the question of the possibility of putting a ballot measure forward for a half-cent sales tax issue that would be devoted to transportation, infrastructure improvements. That's a measure that's passed in many, many counties in this state. Has to have measures that look to fund open space preservation and other items. And so I think that that's on the table, and I think we need to leave it on the table and have a considered discussion over whether we think that's a way to go. The other thing I would simply note at this point is that our transient occupancy tax in the unincorporated areas is 1% lower than it is in any other parts of the county. Within the cities, the transient occupancy tax is 10%, as I understand it. In our unincorporated areas, it's 9%. There, the lodging industry has worked forward with a business improvement district. Again, that's a 2% surcharge that they're levying on themselves. In some incorporated areas, they have gone to 3%, not many. But I know that the lodging industry understands that 1% differential exists. It is within the purview of this board to put that forward as an idea, and my suggestion is that we, again, not take that off the table, that as we look to see what happens at the state level, we may want to revisit that in the next year.
Thank you. I have no other requests at this point from the board. Just a quick comment. You know, I can appreciate the long-term planning aspect, but by the same token, we've got some immediate planning that I think that really needs more concentration. And my concern with some of this long-term planning is, as I've seen at SLOCOG, the 2050 plan, for example. If we ever get this done by 2050, I'm going to be shocked. But by the time we get down the road with a lot of these planning processes, we have to go back and do it again. So I guess what I would, as was mentioned earlier, the impact to those planning processes relative to the budget, that would be an analysis that I'd like to see. How does this affect it in the long term? What are the costs relative to that? And that way I can make a much more informed decision on that. Okay. With that,
I'm prepared with a motion, Mr. Chairman. I believe staff has received direction. I don't think there's any uncertainty there. But I would move that beyond direction received under this discussion, that we do direct all departments to incorporate the prioritized list of reductions, resource and expense reductions into the upcoming 11-12 budget submittals, that we continue that they implement the budget balancing strategy. I'm going to have real trouble with that. Budget balancing strategies that we have considered today.
Second.
You want to say that three times?
BBS.
I have a motion by Supervisor Gibson, seconded by Supervisor Hill. All in favor indicate by saying aye.
I have a...
Wait a minute.
Just a comment. Would that include under the departments incorporating the prioritized list to also include a narrative on the impact?
Exactly.
Yes. All indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. We're going to take a 10-minute break. We'll be back at 10:10, and we'll conclude with the final item. because we haven't said anything. I'm waiting on a couple of my colleagues to return.
You have a quorum.
I think we can get started with the report. Okay, let's go. We'll go live. Madam Clerk, final topic of discussion.
Item A3 is consideration of a report regarding the county's labor negotiation strategy for fiscal year 2011-2012.
Thank you. Mr. Grant.
Thank you, Jim Grant, County Administrator. This next item does deal with the labor negotiation strategy. Tammy Douglas-Schatz, the HR Director, will be presenting this. So the reason we're bringing this today, again, it's a companion piece really to what we've been talking about, the budget and the impacts that it has on the budget and our shortfalls. Consider that labor costs do make up about 60% of the county's operating budget, so it's certainly the largest portion of our expenditure that we have in the county. And for every 1% increase in salary and benefits for employees cost about $2.3 million. So we want to talk about that today. The strategies certainly are subject to negotiations, and so we want to present the board these strategies today and have your board reaffirm some of the things that we've already been directed to do and are doing in the labor negotiations area. So I'll turn it over to Ms. Tammy Douglas-Schatz.
Jim, Chairman Meacham, members of the board, Tammy Douglas-Schatz, Human Resources. Mr. Grant pointed out, these are our general overall strategies for labor negotiations. And as your board is well aware, we've done a lot of reevaluating of the labor program in the last year. We transferred the labor program from administration to human resources, and we did a request for qualifications for professional services and selected Rennie Sloan, Holtzman, and Sakai to provide us those services. This is really an important discussion for us to have today in light of the budget. As Mr. Grant pointed out, 60% of the county's budget is labor costs. And in addition to that, we need to negotiate over a big portion of that, because 85% of county employees are represented by employee associations, and we need to meet and confer over wages as well as working conditions with employee associations. What we're here to present today is a three-point plan, a general negotiation strategy that includes pension cost sharing, a second-tier pension plan, and then the implementation of the prevailing wage ordinance in light of some new valuations of the prevailing wage ordinance and who our external wage market is. The first point, pension cost sharing, we have a major philosophy that we're operating under, and that is that the county and its employees share equal responsibility to maintain the funding of the pension plan. And we want to split any pension costs with employees 50-50. So we have had recent pension in costs that we need to split 50-50, as well as a long-term sustainability plan to share the overall cost of the pension plan with employees 50-50. Every year, the pension trust conducts an actuarial assessment, and as actuarial conditions change from year to year, increases may be required to maintain proper funding. Now, someday we may get lucky and see decreases, and that would be great, but right now we are just worried about increases. Since 2007, there have been two rate increases that have cost about a 10% increase, and all unrepresented employees and the majority of represented employees have absorbed half of these increases. We will continue to bargain these pension increases with any employee organizations that have not yet shared in these costs, and we will continue to bargain future rate increases to achieve the goal of a 50-50 split. To give you a general idea of our current pension costs, and I say general because these are averages, these are our pension costs in San Luis Obispo County compared to PERS in 37 Act counties. And it's broken down between the employee share and the employer's share of that cost. So if you look at the totals, San Luis Obispo County spends about 35% of its payroll on its pension plan. compared to PERS and 37 Act counties, we're right in the ballpark, if not on the lower end of the average, and those range from 30 to 45%. In all pension plans, there is some split of costs between employer share and employee share, and in our county, we actually share greater overall than in PERS and 37 Act counties on average. In the county of San Luis Obispo, our employer share is 20.66%, and the employee share is 14.38% on average. Now, our pension plan is an independent pension plan, and the way that the plan reads is that your contribution as an employee varies based on your age of entry. So the younger you are when you start, the lower your employee share of costs. So that 14.38% is an average. In PERS and 37 Act counties, most employee share is between 5 and 10%. I do want to point out that the parenthetical percentages there, the county pickup percentages that are between 8 and 9% that are the under the employee share, those refer to county costs that over the years the county and the employees associations have negotiated compensation increases, and the county chose, along with in the negotiation process, with the Employees Association, to put compensation increases into the county pickup. So if you subtract the county's pickup from the employee share of costs, the employee's out-of-pocket costs are, you know, between 4 and 5%, depending on their actual share. So if we move toward our goal of sharing pension costs 50-50, looking at this chart, it would change the ratio or the rate of county and employee sharing to, if we look at the 35.04% as our ongoing pension costs, if we share 50-50, the county's costs would decrease to 17.5% and the employee's costs would increase 17.5%. So that's what it would look like if we met the 50-50 goal. The second part of our plan, point two, is to move to a second tier pension plan. And we would want to negotiate and implement a second lower tier pension plan for employees hired on or after January 1st, 2011, which is coming right up. And we will meet that date with unrepresented employees, and with represented employees, we will make a goal of negotiating to that date or as close to it as we can. The second tier pension is designed to essentially roll back the defined pension plan to that of 10 to 15 years ago. A second tier is necessary because the law requires that existing employees' pension plans remain the same as they were when those people were hired. So a second tier allows us to bring in new employees at this lower plan rate, and because they're being hired at this lower plan rate, they have time to plan for their retirement. We would start seeing savings on the second tier in about 8 to 10 years. That, of course, is dependent upon how many people retire, how many people exit county employment, and how many new employees we're able to bring on. But we should start seeing some savings in 8 to 10 years. Once all employees are in the second tier, we will see a savings of about $20 million per year. So if we realized that fully in 20 to 30 years, that's a really significant savings to the county. So we could have a catchphrase, save $20 million in 20. So a little more information on the second tier. For unrepresented management, this includes elected and appointed department heads as well as your board. The current pension plan is 2% at 55. A recommended second-tier plan is 2% at 60. There's a lot of components that go into second-tier pension plans. If you go to single highest year or the top three-year average, and all of those things are need to be figured out with regard to how we implement the second-tier pension. But that 2% at 60 is the overall pension rate. And then with every other employee association, we need to negotiate what that second tier looks like. But the goal is that it would be, at a higher, a lower pension benefit. So the third point in our general strategy is with regard to the prevailing wage ordinance and how we survey the market to determine wages. Currently, we're operating under a voter-approved prevailing wage ordinance, and essentially, the prevailing wage ordinance says that county employees shall be compensated equal to that of similar jobs in government or private industry. And the prevailing wage ordinance also states that wages are ultimately determined through the collective bargaining process. And that prevailing wage ordinance has been around since the 70s and was updated in the 80s. So it's been around a long time. And over the years and through negotiations in good times, the different memorandums of understandings with the different employee associations have evolved and interpreted that prevailing wage ordinance in a variety of ways. And some of the contracts that the county is obligated to operate under require the county to survey in a very defined manner, and whatever the survey says, then we are obligated to provide that wage increase in a formulaic manner, and we're not really negotiating once we're required to follow a formula, and we're not negotiating on the other end. We've only negotiated on the front end of that contract. So that's our current practice now. To update the practice, we're still obligated to follow the prevailing wage ordinance, but we have been really looking at that and evaluating whether what we're doing makes sense and really matches what the prevailing wage ordinance says. So we've looked at a new external market to find new comparison agencies, or really to broaden our comparison agencies and to base those comparison agencies on objective criteria rather than the criteria that has evolved over the years where, people have negotiated to meet their needs, to get higher wages or to hold wages steady. And then if we have objective criteria to identify our new market, then we can use that to survey, and then we want to utilize that survey data as a basis for negotiation. We don't want to have a contract language that locks us into formulaic increases. We want to be able to negotiate increases based upon a survey. We certainly, when we're negotiating, need to be able to consider the county's financial situation. It's been very tough when we had contractual obligations that required us to give salary increases, even though we have a severe budget deficit. So I want to talk a little bit about how we went about identifying what we think our new labor market ought to look like. We've in the past had some labor contracts have had 5 comparison counties, others have had 7 where each the county and the employee association strikes one. I mean, there's just a variety of ways that we've found ourselves. But if we step back from the self-interest of any group and just looked at criteria, objective criteria for determining a proper labor market, we picked out some criteria that we thought was really important, and that is geographic proximity as the first and foremost one. 75% of the county's hires come from within San Luis Obispo County. And so we know that we're competing with local employers and geographically proximate employers for employees. So we need to, our labor market is definitely local. We also need to look at the nature of services. Certainly, predominantly counties provide services like counties, so we need to have lots of counties to compare our wages to. But because so many of our employees that we hire come from the local economy, we need to consider other local public agencies and the local private labor market. Employer size is important because similar-sized employers have similar-sized positions to compare to. And we also needed to look at economic similarity. There are economic indicators in a variety of counties that match San Luis Obispo County, and demographic data that comes close to San Luis Obispo County, and our theory is that those counties are and agencies are most like our county. So So our first recommendation regarding survey agencies included the local market, and we want to compare ourselves to the city of San Luis Obispo, the state of California, because there are a lot of state employees in our county, Cal Poly, a significant employer in the area, as well as the San Luis Coastal School District. Surrounding counties that meet the criteria of proximity are Fresno, Kern, Kings, Monterey, Santa Barbara, and Ventura. There they are on the map. You can see that they're close. Demographically, similar counties, and this includes all sorts of demographics with regard to population, education, and economic indicators, with housing prices and any economic indicator that was significantly like San Luis Obispo County, and those are El Dorado County, Sonoma, Placer, and Santa Cruz counties. There they are. So what we're currently doing that your board has directed in the past is we are utilizing these new survey agencies with unrepresented employees. Any unrepresented employee that we need to conduct a wage survey for, we are using those new comparisons. And any employee organization that we're currently negotiating with, we are negotiating this new process with. And we are also negotiating to change any MOU language that includes a formulaic wage process where it sticks the county in a position of having to give a formulaic wage increase. Obviously, we want to be able to negotiate wages with this new approach to prevailing wage based on our new approach and budgetary constraints. It makes all the sense in the world that we need to consider the county's budget while we're negotiating. And we're also asking your board to direct us to rewrite any county ordinances that need to be rewritten to bring in line with this new approach, and that includes unrepresented management and your board's compensation ordinance. And we would return to your board with a recommendation for specific language regarding your new ordinance if this is approved. So the recommendations that we're asking you to act on today are for you to receive and approve this status update and implement this three-point plan. Direct us to continue to implement these strategies and direct us to return to your board with changes to any ordinances that need to be changed. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Oh, quick question regarding the comparisons. If you back up about three slides, next one. There. Local, City of San Luis Obispo. Why would you not take an average of the seven cities as opposed to San Luis Obispo, which is the highest of all of the cities?
That's a good question. You know, I asked Mark Gregerson of Rennie Sloan Holtzman Sakai, who did a lot of the research, to join us, and I'm sure he would. I could give it a shot, but Mark, you want to just give
sure.
the full answer?
Sure. We could. The city of San Luis Obispo is large. It's local. It's the county seat. We thought that was just a better indicator of comparisons, and that's why we recommended to put it into the mix.
I guess I have to disagree with that, but that's just me. Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gregerson was at the lectern. I was maybe he or Ms. Schatz comment also. One of the issues is also the potential of surveying private industry on this, and I wonder if you have any comments about how that might be folded into this process.
Yeah, I'll start, and then you can add on. Thank you. I actually should have included that in my presentation. We do want to include private industry wherever it makes sense, and it's one of those situations where, depending on the classifications that we're surveying, some will make more sense for different private industry groups than others, and it's sometimes challenging to get private sector data. So Rennie Sloan has a method for gathering that private data. So I don't know if you want to add to that, Mark.
Just a little bit. As Tammy had said, there are certain classifications that are really direct comparators, and where we can get a match with our private sector data bank that we use, we will absolutely fold that into the salary recommendations. And we believe that that is necessary because it is specifically mentioned in your prevailing wage ordinance. And our analysis will include private sector data where it's appropriate to include private sector data.
That's good. Thank you. Just a second. I'm going to jump over here. Mr. Sajjan?
Yes, just to follow up.
Go ahead.
Going back to questions similar to it's been already asked about the private sector, because there were times there we were losing employees to private sector. I'm sure that has changed. Going back to the school district as well, because for the St. Louis Unified School District has the benefit of having Diablo Canyon in their district, where there's a large benefit of the property taxes, while other schools don't have that luxury. Again, going back to maybe average of all the cities within the county, why can't we also consider the rest of the school districts in the county?
I think you could. I mean, that's part of the analysis. However, the analysis that's being done with these comparators is really not a final point. I mean, Tammy had indicated the kind of getting away from the formulaic approach to increases. These are surveys in order to really generally assess market comparability and will be used for the purposes of negotiations. And when we selected those comparators, we thought it was appropriate to include not all of them, but only significant samples that we felt would include the most potential for matches to San Luis Obispo County employees.
Another comment I want to make, that times like these, instead of focusing on how can we save their jobs rather than try to match another county by giving more money and then being forced to have less employees, I'd like to bring that into the formula somehow.
And this is not a formulaic approach. I think that's a huge shift from the status quo. The current practice in the labor contracts is a formulaic approach that surveys then each year. There's an increase that comes from that, and then that increase is implemented. Or in some cases, when the county can't afford to pay that increase, then there's negotiations in order to mediate some of that impact. What's being suggested is a complete shift away from that. That is to conduct the wage and benefit survey, set your salary structure based on a competitive market, and then actually negotiate. And negotiate each year when those increases come up, as opposed to being tied to a formula that automatically generates an increase and does not take into account the county's financial condition at that particular point. So this is a huge shift, and I think a significant shift. And the survey that's done really just forms a basis to negotiate. Obviously, it's to the county's interest in order to be competitive. Your prevailing wage ordinance requires you to look at that competitive market, but it's also important to have the ability to negotiate those increases at the times that are really close to your budget cycle. This gives you the opportunity to do that.
Patterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that Supervisor Meacham and Supervisor Sajjan raised good points about making the comparisons and to the private sector and public sector and the representation of the school district and the city of San Luis Obispo. I'm wondering if comparing some job classification using the private sector, where there are comparable comparisons to be made, and not using it in others, skews the results, or could skew the results, and I think it's important to consider that. Also, you're challenged with what do you use and what don't you use, and I think we want as much data as we can possibly get, but I think in the analysis, you point out the shortcomings. The example that Supervisor Sajjan used, for example, San Luis Unified School District receives much greater revenue than the other school districts in the county. And I think if you're only going to use San Luis Coastal, you need to point that out or bring in a couple of the other larger school districts so it balances that a little bit. Same with the city of San Luis Obispo. While it may be the county seat and more like San Luis Obispo County government, I think it's important to take a look at the outlying incorporated cities as well and see how they fit in the mix and at least point those out.
Okay, I have nobody else light on. And I guess just kind of a follow-up to that is that we saw recently an article about city managers and what they received, and then there was quite a disproportionate amount there. So I guess looking at the overall cost of the cities, you know, I think the public really would like to see more of an average, because I guess you could equate this to using Marin County in the five counties that was talked about in prior years, very high income area. And so I think these comparative counties that you've suggested now make a whole lot more sense. I mean, they're much more closer to us, but I think the cities would be much more better served by that incorporation as well. Okay, I'm going to go to the public at this point. I have Kimberly Daniels and then Andy Caldwell.
Good morning, Chairman Meacham and members of the board. You knew I'd be here for this.
Yes, ma'am.
Since we have not quite concluded contract negotiations, I am not going to comment on prevailing wage proposal. And since we haven't really actively started negotiations on pension, I am going to comment on that. I would like to request from Ms. Douglas-Schatz the data that she used to compare the figures for the 37 Act and CalPERS counties and cities, whatever entities that were used, because it differs than information I've been able to gather from my counterparts who are doing this in the surrounding cities and counties. The one thing that I noted in the staff report is the report continually addresses what is happening with the representative labor groups. It does not discuss what is going to be happening with the management and the department heads, elected or otherwise, and the board of supervisors. The folks I represent will never end up in the $100,000 club. They just don't have the salaries that will put them there. I am concerned when you look at the average at the disproportionate impact it has on the folks that I represent, because they are not the ones that you are paying the highest pension contribution on. They are not the ones that the county is paying the highest pickup on. There's a 5% spread between what the county pays in pickup on the folks I represent and what they pay on your elected officials and appointed department heads and even the board. We have always been the ones to step up and partner with the county to save positions. We have saved a significant amount of money for the county over the past couple of years because we're realists and we recognize that times have been rough. And we have SLOSIA represented employees are the ones that saved the jobs of SLOSIA represented employees because they deferred salary increases. They deferred benefit contributions that they had negotiated. So we have been there. We have stepped up time and time and time again. What I don't see is any mention of changing the management retirement plan that allows the 9.29% pickup that the county picks up of the employee's contribution to be pensionable. So in essence, at retirement time, increases management's pension by 9.29%. It's used to inflate the salary. I don't see any mention of eliminating the $450 a month car allowance from being pensionable. Those are all things that your board can do, and I would ask you to look at those. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Caldwell, followed by Mr. Seabock.
Chairman Meacham, I'm Andy Caldwell representing CoLab. In this case, I need to praise you for the fact that you are taking some solid steps here, things that we've not seen in Santa Barbara County. However, the elephant in the room throughout the state of California is defined contribution plans. You're talking about pulling your defined benefit plan back, but we believe that the contribution plan is untenable.
I've had a number of people on the radio show over the years that actually were warning about this before the stock market crashed. The bottom line is if you're figuring in 5% return on investment, and you have an employee that's going to be getting a $50,000 annual pension, somewheres $1 million has to be in an account per employee. $1 million at 5% return. And this guy wrote this article, you know, 5 to 10 years ago, get land estate job, become a millionaire. Because in essence, you have a $1 million pension, a personal pension fund guaranteed for life. That is unsustainable. And a salary comparisons that do not take into account the full cost of the pensions are worthless. I was in HR before I got into CoLab for one of the largest, oldest companies in Santa Maria. And the bottom line is when you add the salaries plus the benefits, the public sector is getting 30 to 40% more money than the private sector. It's 30 to 40% more. And a lot of that has to do with the pensions. And so the bottom line here is we think you need to put defined contribution on the table if you're really going to solve this problem in the long run. And I would agree with what the union rep says. I don't think you can balance this on the back of those employees that are never going to reach that $50,000 a year pension or $100,000 a year salary. But the point is, though, is public safety for a lot of people is the highest priority, and they are the best paid. And so this is a conundrum. We don't pretend this is an easy problem to solve in any way, shape, or form. But the bottom line is we have more government than we can afford. And most people in the private sector are going to have to rely on Social Security. They don't have $1 million account out there that they can draw from regardless of market returns. It's an unrealistic world. It's totally unrealistic that somebody would be guaranteed a defined benefit regardless of the market performance. We ask that you would change that.
Thank you. Mr. Seabach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Jerry Seabach, I'm County Auditor Controller. And I want to say up front that this effort is a good effort that you're engaged in. I got some good people working on it from county staff and good consultants, and I generally support everything in this plan. And I have been one that's been critical in the past of the formulaic just cranking out pay increases across the board without looking at specific needs at different classes, and not looking at the overall availability of funding, which is now a big problem. But what I want to caution you about is, well, let's go back to your previous presentation. If you look at the County of San Luis Obispo's financial condition, its level of services for the citizens, and if you look at the level of taxes, we don't have extra taxes. We don't have a half-cent sales tax right now, as they do in Santa Barbara and Monterey counties, our direct neighbors. We don't have a higher bed tax like in Monterey and even in other cities in this county. The taxes are relatively low. The services are high. The achievement of this county is good. I would put it in the top 10% of all the counties, if not more, statewide. I'm proud of that. I've been working here a long time. My problem is with what do you do with this new survey data? And as I understand it, the idea is to negotiate down to the median number. So you take whatever the salary is for a class and try to hit whatever the median is out of that universe of comparisons. My view is that's a formula for mediocrity, and I don't think that's what we want for our county. You could make the formula, we want to be better in the median to attract people to achieve excellence. Your mission statements all say we're going to be excellent. We're not going to be mediocre. So that's my issue with it. Will you please give that some thought?
Thank you, sir. That concludes our public comment portion of this. I'm going to go to the board. Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping Ms. Douglas Schatz could address some of the issues brought up by Ms. Daniels. I know that part of the direction of staff would update the ordinance that would apply to the Board of Supervisors, meaning we would also, you know, sort of lead the way in this way, and I think the Board of Supervisors has shown its willingness as well to make cuts and to live more lean. But management is certainly, and that often is the case where the public is more concerned about the pay and benefits of management, and I wonder how that's going to apply as well, rather than just all the line employees.
And just as a follow-up there, too, that I know that the comment was made that the SOSLIA has stepped up and they deferred. We understand that. You're not the only one. The board took the prerogative to cut our salaries, not defer them, cut them.
Thank you. With regard to the management ordinance, the management ordinance is worded in a way that already allows the board to make any adjustments to how management wages are surveyed and how management wages are meted out. So I did put in the presentation here that we'd look at that at the management ordinance, but the way we're reading it now, we don't need to make any changes to make these exact changes for management. I also had mentioned previously in a previous board meeting, and would like to repeat here that management employees have actually stepped up as well. They haven't had an increase in 3 years and have also taken the 50-50 split in any pension increases. And so as recently as last month, management employees took a pay cut because they did not get a pay increase to offset the pension increases. So actually our management employees have done quite a bit, and what we're seeing in our salary table is that because we have formulaic and required increases for represented employees, and we have held management wages down, there is actually been a compaction of management wages to represented employee wages. So I would hesitate to hammer on management's not doing enough. I mean, there's always more to be done, but they've done quite a bit.
One more comment, too, if I could, Mr. Chair, to Mr. Seabach's comment, and I'm in agreement that I think that, you know, we can defend well-paid, well-benefited, excellent employees. I mean, we should do that. I mean, we're in the business of serving the public, and we have good public servants. In an expensive, very expensive place to live, it's different than in other places. But I do think that the public expects us to look at how we are doing things and how we have done things. Certainly the formulaic process of the prevailing wage, I mean, to embrace it now in its semantic richness, perhaps, is, I think, responsible, rather than to just sort of continue to see this spiral upward. But I don't have I think that we can, and we should, certainly the elected should be able to defend the well-paid and well-benefited employees that are delivering excellent service to our community. I know that there's a kind of knee-jerk reaction, and we sometimes get emails about firing everybody and replacing them with Kelly girls or something. But, I don't really think that would serve our community well. Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Mr. Hill. We should have well-paid, well-benefited, high-performing employees. We need that, especially now in a time when government organizations are faced, as they have been year after year after year for a long time, with doing more with less. You know, ultimately, our labor negotiations program, our labor relations program, is about being fair to employees, being competitive in the job market, and attracting the best talent that we can to get the job done.
I would observe, and it's in the staff report, Ms. Douglas-Schatz didn't put it up in her PowerPoint, though, that our prevailing wage ordinance is not, how shall we say, a model of crystal clarity. It has rather vague language. It's interesting to me, I'd forgotten that it had been amended once, at least once. But even as you read the language cold off the page, it does not provide a formula, does not necessarily provide a lot of clear guidance. I would hope that that in this time of change we can come to an understanding of our labor relations in this county, which does emphasize those various components that I just spoke of and include fairness to employees, and propose perhaps an amendment to our prevailing wage ordinance that would memorialize those. And again, that's not there. I know there are those who have the quick knee jerk there that Supervisor Gibson's talking about, you know, taking it out on the rank and file. That's not the case. I think we need to come to a rational basis for fair compensation. And I understand the intent of our prevailing wage ordinance, but how that particular set of words gets implemented is problematic or challenging, to say the least. I guess the other thing that I would comment is that we heard from Ms. Daniels about a lot of the items, details of the question of pensions and what should be pensionable and how much pickup should be made for different employees and different, whether other comment or question of defined contribution versus defined benefit. I think that question of pensionability, that question of the structure, the exact structure of a pension, is still an item for negotiation. I don't see that the compensation picture is going to change overnight. We heard from Ms. Douglas-Schatz that a second-tier pension is not going to be wake up tomorrow in a new world. It's going to take at least a decade and maybe two or three to really see that. But quite clearly, I think we have to be there for the long haul, and we have to embark on that. So I think that we have taken a number of steps in the right direction. Certainly pledge continued openness in the discussion of the details as we move forward into a new way of doing things. I think it's going to be very important for this organization and for this the residents of this county.
Thank you. And I think that I'll comment quickly on Mr. Seabock's point. It's a point well taken. The county does not expect mediocrity. But I think what we're trying to accomplish here is the long-term stability for this county. And can we continue to provide the workforce, the quality, and all that we've come to expect here, can we do that? Is it sustainable by the methods we're trying to put in place? The public demands it of us, and I think it's our responsibility to look in that direction. Mr. Patterson?
Yes, just to follow up, I concur with all the comments that my colleagues have made on the board. We've made tremendous progress over the course of the last 2 years dealing with our employees at all levels, and I appreciate everybody's engagement and participation in this effort. And I think we can continue to make progress that will give us long-term stability, maintaining the high levels that we strive for. And one thing that is often overlooked in compensation, and I don't know that you can really quantify it, but it's the quality of life that we enjoy in San Luis Obispo County. There's certainly a benefit to working and living here, and we need to, I think, continue to be aware of that as well.
Okay. I'm going to try to get us out of here by noon, so we
okay.
don't want
to work. With that, I'll move staff's recommendation.
Is there a second?
Second.
Been moved by Supervisor Patterson, seconded by Supervisor Hill. All in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Mr. Jensen, closed session.
Approximately 45 minutes.
I have no request to speak from the public on closed session. We will adjourn to closed session and report out afterwards. Thank you.